Today on Piled High and Deep, the podcast, we're shoveling with a biologist who spent an awful lot of time with Drosophila. That's also known as the common fruit fly. Well, his path started his senior year of high school. It was in an honors biology class. But if you'd asked him then about what he'd be doing now, he didn't think he'd end up being a biologist.
Now, you can take DNA and you can cut it in a specific place and put two of them together and make new DNA and make it do new things. And I just looked at that and went, oh, okay, that's what I'm going to do. And, you know, that's called genetic engineering. And that's why, stupidly, I went into engineering.
Well, no need to worry. He's found his calling. And more. You see, our doctor today has also woven in a passion for video games in with his biology expertise. And you might see him at a science fiction convention talking about the science of video games and other cool things where we interlay science fiction with real science. He also talks about the biology of fantasy novels. You know, Harry Potter and all sorts of cool stuff. Well, it's not a bad story for a kid from the steel mills. Piled High and Deep, the podcast, is created by Mountain Geek Productions. That's me, Ted Conte Jr. I have a website. It's themountaingeek.net. It hosts this podcast as well as previous podcast episodes. Also, I've got some other writings and thoughts, etc. Check it out. On the Twitter, the podcast is at PhD Podcast, and you can find me at The Mountain Geek. Also bouncing around somewhere on Facebook. You're going to like our guest today. It's a nice little adventure from Western Pennsylvania. Grew up in a steel mill town, and now he's at Duke University. Oh, and by the way, we're talking about Douglas Adams. Let's start shoveling. By the way, happy International Towel Day.
I saw that. Yeah.
He is my favorite author.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. And it's hard to believe that it's been, you know, 16 years since he passed. But 2001, that was a horrible year, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. That. And it was just, I use that as an example for how, like, truly creative and off-the-wall thinking you can really have in just any kind of media. Right. You know, just I play video games and it's all like, oh, look, everything's a biped. And then you get to Douglas Adams and it's like a super intelligent shade of blue. And you go, oh, that's kind of crazy, but OK.
You work with a lot of students. And I'm wondering if, you know, one of my, you know, for lack of a better word, complaint is that in all the science fiction that we get, it seems to be that you're right. They're all bipeds. You know, my son and I are working through, we have this tradition where we go through TNG every summer.
Oh, wow. That's some heavy lifting, I gotta say.
Yeah, it is. But even in the Star Wars universe, as creative as they are from the waist up, they're still two legs.
Yeah. Yep.
You're a biologist. In all the diversity that's here on Earth, there's got to be advanced civilizations out there that, you know, aren't bipedal.
Right. And I think the best example for it is if you ever play the video game Mass Effect, where in the original trilogy, there were a few, or at least one species was a quadruped. No, actually, there were a few different like insectoid and quadrupeds. And so that was one of the things I liked about it. It was, you know, not completely all bilaterally symmetrical bipeds. And yeah, the new one, darn it, they're all bipeds. but I totally agree, right? Like if you think about it, you go, well, the kind of intelligence that's on Earth right now has evolved, what, over the last, oh, let's even round up crazy to like 100,000 years, right? And you go, all right, so if there hadn't been this asteroid, would the planet have really turned out like that dinosaurs TV show from the 80s, right? Where it's just like, you know, smart reptiles walking around. And, you know, there were quite a few quadrupeds there. Yeah. It's not like we were the apex predator in any situation. So it's not like the T-Rexes are going to be the dominant ones.
Right. Well, I think even getting back to Douglas Adams, he certainly made an argument that we are not the smartest beings on this page.
Yeah. Yeah.
So long and thanks for all the fish. So, Eric Spana, yeah. Thank you very much for joining me. Thanks to Zencaster. I don't have to be in North Carolina, and Eric doesn't have to be in Denver, Colorado.
I'm a little disappointed, I got to say.
Well, I got to tell you, if you're a skier, A-Basin is still open for 3 more weeks.
I'm not even sure I know what that means.
No, but. Okay. A-Basin is a ski area here. It's about 40 miles, 50 miles from Denver, and they're usually the first to open and the last to close. And thanks to some really heavy snow that we had in the last 10 days or so, folks are still skiing. So rather than camping, some people are probably going to be skiing for Memorial Day weekend.
That's kind of crazy. Like, wow.
Eric and I were connected by a previous guest on the podcast, Aaron McDonald.
Mm-hmm.
And Eric and Aaron do or have done in the past a couple of talks at science fiction conventions on, now, if correct me if I'm getting this wrong, but it's the science of the video game Mass Effect that you talked about before. What do you talk about in there?
For one of them, the first one started off as really kind of a love letter to the science that they get right, because it's pretty unusual. Usually, you know, you sit and you play a video game, which is written and directed for a big audience, and they don't put a ton of detail in it. And in Mass Effect, the different, the aliens in your universe are clearly inspired and represented by species on Earth, right? So there's reptilian species and there's avian species and stuff like that, which, you know, wouldn't have to really be in space, but, you know, it makes it familiar for us to see it. But then it got to a point where, you know, the amphibian species, you know, you had to do a little quest to help them get an incubator for their eggs. And you went, oh, right, they're amphibians. They'd have eggs and clutches. Oh, holy crap, that's right. And I sort of went through and going and worked out that, yeah, they actually got a lot of stuff really right. And that was the start of it. And then Aaron came in and helped do some really good astrophysics and astronomy stuff. And then we kind of veered off into the bad science in video games, which, I mean, it's like shooting fish in a barrel. Like it's just so easy.
Are you along the vein? Does it bother you as much as like Neil deGrasse Tyson when he grouses about the bad science in a video game? And I don't necessarily,
part of it does, and part of it I can understand the storytelling license that's okay. Right. So here's my example for okay and not okay. Aaron and I gave a talk about, I don't know why I was there, but it was about physics and video games. I think I was just there so that she didn't have to sit by herself because I'm terrible at physics. But there's a game called Assassin's Creed. And for many things in Assassin's Creed, you leap off a 100-story building and into a pile of hay and you survive. And so we're like, you know, that just seems improbable and unlikely. And you're going to be a greasy spot on the ground. And we had somebody in the audience calculate how deep the hay pile would have to be for you to survive. And they calculated like it would need to be an 85-foot high hay pile. And you go, all right, so I'm kind of okay with the, yeah, everybody knows that's not real, right? You can't jump off a 10-story building into a little pile of hay. On the other hand, the other absurd premise of that game is the DNA memories, which is that's not how memories work. Also, like if you think about it, like what really happens is in that game, you experience a thing. That experience, not just like epigenetic stuff, but like, you know, nucleotide changes happen not in your brain, but in your gonads. Because then you transmit that to your offspring. And then there's a complete dissociation of how independent assortment of chromosomes works. You maintain that information for almost infinite number of offspring, you know. And so it's like 500 years later, though it's been 50 generations and you have almost no DNA the same as that ancestor, yeah, you have their detailed memories. That bugs me. When I got to that game, that was the, Aaron, we should do a bad science in video games because this is making teenagers stupider.
So let's get to the reason why you know all this. What is it that you do during your day job?
Oh, so my day job, I'm an assistant professor of the practice, which means I'm a teaching faculty at Duke University in biology, and I teach molecular biology and genetics and developmental biology. I do fruit flies, Drosophila, as a model system, and we look at I work with undergrads, and so we are working on identifying some of the very oldest mutations that have ever been identified and what the genes are that are mutated and how that works. And so essentially it's become, how do you make wings on fruit flies? But yeah, it's the molecular biology, genetics, and development part that really, it shades your view, right? I view all of media through the guise of my profession, which I think is true for almost everyone. I can't do the physics part, but boy, the genetics part drives me.
Well, it's interesting. It's interesting that you mention how you view the guise of media through your occupation. I work in the insurance industry. Mm. I'm a large loss claims consultant.
Oh, and did you go crazy during Avengers?
Well, yeah, you just start adding it up. And several years ago, after the first Avengers movie came out,
right,
somebody did a study of how much total loss there was result of all the damage. But it is one of those things that, you know, my fellow insurance nerds and I, we do kind of chuckle about, you know, right. Hey, how is that going to be covered? You know,
yeah. But who really is giving the homeowners insurance for Tony Stark? Really? The guy's got nuclear reactors in his house.
Right. Is that being that has suddenly come through the Terran in the space-time continuum, would that be covered under the terrorist policy? I don't know.
Or is that literally an act of God?
Right, yeah.
I'm sorry that Thor destroyed your car. Yeah. That is literally an act of a God. So.
And it's covered. It is covered. Acts of God are covered.
Oh.
So, you know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But
so that's good. So if Hulk destroyed your car, you're in trouble. But yeah. If Thor destroys your car, you're covered.
Okay, we're going to get off track here. Sense it right now real quick that you and I are going to we've got a connection already here. But speaking of Thor and Hulk, mm-hmm. Have you seen the trailer for the new Thor movie?
I have.
I know that guy. We work together.
Yeah. That I have to say I am pretty excited for that movie. Like there were a few of them I wasn't so excited about, but I'm a little overenthused for Ragnarok.
I just love, as my son reminds me, it's the MCU.
Yeah.
Is that what it? Yeah. I was never a comic book guy. It just wasn't one of those things. Music has always been the driver. You know, after family, it's music, and then hard science fiction always came next for me. So the comic book thing always kind of left me behind, and I talked about that in the last episode. Yeah. But it is fun to see these coming to the screen.
Yeah.
And just awesome. The movie, I'm super excited. This is going to be a fun movie summer. Already seen Guardians. As soon as I get my kid caught up on Aliens and Prometheus, we're off to Alien Covenant.
Oh, I'm just gonna end it. For me, it's the how do I not already have tickets for Wonder Woman yet?
Oh man, that one scares the heck out of me.
Are you
nutted up about it? I'm puckered up that can DC just get this one right? This is the most important one.
Yeah, everything about it seems right. Right, it's like somehow they decided, let's not play by the awful DC playbook and make everything dingy and grim. Let's actually have a little fun, and it looks like it's gonna be fun. It looks like it's the first Captain America movie, and
it does. That's a good point.
I'm 100% okay with that.
Yep. So you're a comic book kid growing up.
I was sort of, and by growing up, that was like what? I'm trying like the years I actually owned comic books have been like up to like 79 or 80.
Okay.
Right. And so like, yes, the occasional time I'd be with my parents in a place that sold comic books, I could convince them to buy me one. Yes. And so I have a little box in my closet that has like Avengers comics. Actually, the one I really liked was Avengers with the Guardians of the Galaxy, which I thought was amazing that I had that. And I just found this past summer, I am super excited about this, I found the 3 issues of the Star Wars 1 through 6, I think, that Marvel put out when the first movie came out. Right. And so, oh my God, I have my original Star Wars comic books. And I also have an issue from a few episodes after the original movie, because it happened before Empire came back, and the like absurdist storylines and characters that Marvel came up with. That just was way more fun.
Where was that growing up?
Outside of Pittsburgh. So I am a Yinzer at heart.
A Yinzer at heart. So Iron Curtain days. We are steel family.
Curtain, steel Curtain.
A Steel Curtain, right. Sorry. Yeah, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Iron Curtain was the bad guys.
Hold on. I'm going to edit this part out. Let me make a note here. I did not say Iron Curtain days. No, I'm going to keep it in.
It's okay.
I got to show my closet.
Because it's a tough call, though, right? Because the beer is Iron City beer.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's where I made the mistake. That's where I made the mistake.
Right.
I was a history guy, and I remember reading all the stuff about World War II and how Iron City beer was the only beer that they could get over in the European theater. I also spent a summer hanging out with some guys between my freshman and sophomore year. Working at Animus Mosquito Control, and these 3 guys that ran it, you know, they'd known each other. I grew up in a small town, Durango, Colorado, Southwest Colorado, and they all grew up together, and they all went off to war together. And so all we'd hear at lunch were the same stories, and every story included, we were so happy to get the Iron City beer. Anyway.
That blows my mind. No, nobody's happy to get Iron City beer.
Nobody's happy. Well, nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Yeah, good.
Growing outside of Pittsburgh,
yep.
What did your father do?
My dad worked for 40 years at Allegheny Ludlum Steel. So he worked for a specialty steel company that made stainless steel that was used in like, True Temper golf shafts and like silverware and stuff like that. And when the entire steel industry went into the toilet during the Reagan administration, his expanded because it was specialty steel and the defense contractors needed it, right? They needed it for fancy airplanes and things. So yeah, he was, it was lucky that he actually managed to keep his job at the, and those mills are still running, for 40 years.
So what did he do at the mill? Was he working on the floor?
He, let's see. He was an electrical technician for, the last, I don't know, 10 or 15 years.
So he was he got his hands dirty every day.
Yeah. He got his hands dirty every day. And that was why he thought I should go into engineering, because, you know, he actually had to do stuff and engineers could just show up and go, so V equals IR. I don't know, Joe, what do you think? And he'd fix it. I spent a year in college as an engineer.
What about your mom?
Worked at a liquor store. So she worked at a state liquor store, which was, you know, disappointing for my friends.
Right.
But Pennsylvania, the state liquor stores are stupid because they only sell liquor and wine.
Where do you get your beer?
Pennsylvania is still the most backwards place on earth. In Pennsylvania, you buy beer in 24 packs from a beer distributor or from 6 packs from a bar as takeout.
Okay.
You can't buy beer and wine at the same place.
Whatever. Colorado only started selling alcohol on Sundays about 5 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know what? I can go down the street and buy an ounce. Not that I do that anymore.
That's amazing. And from what I understand, Colorado is just sort of printing their own money.
In some respects they are. In other respects, we don't know where that printed money is always going. And then with the fact that you have the printed money, the banks can't take it.
I mean the tax revenue from it.
No,
right?
There is that too, yes. But what's also interesting is that you can't necessarily pay your taxes with cash when the government doesn't let you have a bank account because anyway. Off topic here.
That's amazing. So they kind of need to have everyone pay in checks.
Yes. Yeah, right. Yeah.
It's going to be the revival of the check writing industry.
I remember the first time I went in to buy to one of those stores and I used my debit card and I got home and I went, "Hey, honey, look what I bought." And she says, "You never have cash. How did you do that?" "I put it on the credit card." I got one of those looks that you get from a wife that you've been, you know, with for over 20 years that, you know, you just have dummy written on your forehead. So your father's working in the steel mills, your mom in a liquor store. Those are blue collar jobs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did they push the importance of education on you?
Oh,
then?
They most certainly did. Like they were huge advocates of, no, you're going to get an edge because they both have high school degrees and they were huge advocates of you're going to get an education and a great job because great jobs come from education. And so they had 5 kids. That includes, if I get correctly, 2 PhDs, masters or 2 masters and a bachelor's.
What's the other PhD?
Clinical psychology. He's a psychologist in Florida.
The expectation was on day one of kindergarten, this is just the beginning. You're going all the way to college.
Yes. Oh, actually, let's get to that. Most definitely. Yes. Because my oldest sister is 16 years older than me. So she was, in college or out of college when I hit kindergarten.
Right. Okay.
So absolutely. Like there was just no doubt. It was only a matter of where you went to college and, where my parents live is about 5 miles from a Penn State branch campus. So you can always live at home for the first 2 years of college at a, you know, a high quality university. So
what was that public education like for you? Where did you find you excelled? What jazzed you?
I think for me that I don't know, because I was always in the little sort of accelerated gifted programs through elementary school and through high school and stuff like that. But it was what do I want to actually do? I think wasn't until like whatever it was, honors biology in my senior year in high school, where they're like, no, you can take DNA and you can cut it in a specific place and put two of them together and make new DNA and make it do new things. And I just looked at that and went, oh, okay, that's what I'm going to do. And, you know, that's called genetic engineering. And that's why, stupidly, I went into engineering.
Because you thought the engineering came before the genetics?
Right. Like, it was like, well, what kind of engineer do you want to be? A genetic engineer. Like, yeah, well, that's not actually a thing.
That's not in this building.
I only figured that out after my first year in engineering, where then I went, okay, your options are civil, mechanical, chemical, electrical. And I'm like, what, genetic? I need to go be a biology major. Oh, okay. Oh, that's awesome. That I don't have to take all these crappy classes. I can go be a biology major.
Where did you do the undergrad?
University of Pittsburgh. So I went to college 45 minutes from my parents' house.
Let's see. I looked at your, when did you graduate? You were there in the Jim Kelly days.
Marino?
Marino days.
No, I went to college at Pitt because of Marino. Because my brother went to college at Pitt during the Marino years.
Gotcha.
Actually met Dan Marino at an astronomy class. And then had taken me, as I was in probably middle school time, took me to see football games there and watch Dan Marino just destroy people.
Right.
And then, then when I went there, it was the Ironhead Hayward years, where Ironhead was an amazing running back. His son now plays for the Steelers. And so I laughed with the students that go to Duke, because they've put this huge amount of effort and thought and like, where do I want to go to college? And, you know, they've looked at every university across the country. And I'm like, I went to college down the street because I went to see Dan Marino play football. In retrospect, yeah, I probably should have put better thought into it, but, you know, I didn't really know exactly what I was looking for anyway, and there was no way we were going to pay out-of-state tuition, so it works.
You and I are – I'm just a couple of months from turning 50. I think you're
– Yeah, me too.
And
sucks.
I have kids. My daughter just finished her freshman year in college. I got a kid that's, as of today, will be a sophomore in high school. And so one of those things that I really look at, you know, obviously looking at is the college, the college thing. You work at one of those schools. Well, my kid, we're in the Cherry Creek School District. It's a very well-known school district around the nation, high achievers, Cherry Creek High School, one of those high-achieving places. So there's always a handful of kids from Cherry Creek that we're hearing about going to Duke.
Oh, nice.
And that's my point in the statement, and then the question is that you just went to the school down the road from you.
Right.
I went to an in-state school that was 8 hours from my small hometown. I went to the University of Colorado Boulder.
That's 8 hours away?
Oh, or 7 hours away, yeah.
Oh, my God. I didn't realize it took that long to drive across Colorado.
Yeah, that's an East Coast bias.
Yeah, like, clearly.
Yeah, and I have friends, East Coast folks that I know, and you know, I think nothing of jumping in the car for 6 hours to go down and see my mom or to go camping or whatever.
That's just the thought, somebody
from the East Coast. And I know I'm just painting a very broad stroke here, but
it's absolutely true.
You're going to sit in a car for 6 hours.
I wouldn't drive 90 minutes like that. And I've known people from Texas, like, my morning commute is 2 hours. Yeah. and it's all highway.
Yeah. Those are people that live in the hellhole of Houston, and there's, you know.
Yeah, I think it literally was I live in the suburbs of Houston and worked in Galveston.
Yeah. Yep.
Like,
but my point.
Yeah.
The point is that, I mean, you work at one of those top prestigious universities, and I'm wondering, would you have ever thought of doing something like that 20 or 30 years ago when you headed off to college?
To apply to this kind of school?
Yeah.
No, not at all. Like, and theoretically sort of, because I also applied to the other university down the street, which is Carnegie Mellon. but I didn't get in. So, you know, if this one were down the street, yeah. But I wasn't mentally prepared to really leave home in that sort of way. Okay. And I probably wouldn't have fit in at, I definitely wouldn't have fit in at Duke anyway.
Were you a good student in high school?
Sort of. I got, adequate grades. Did I like work hard at it to achieve? No, at all. Cause it all comes kind of easy.
Right.
And so you don't have to work at it hard. And you have bad traits, right? You're like,
oh yeah.
If things are easy, you don't work hard for it. Yep. And so, got into college, didn't do well because I had to actually work at it now. I mean, even after college, I never would have considered, like, you know, when I went to graduate school, which literally was to avoid getting a job. That, you know, where I applied in retrospect, I probably undershot like the qualities of universities, because at the time there was just no good mechanism to see, you know, where you might fit. Like, it was, you know, it was pulling little pamphlets off of the wall and sending in free postcards so that they could send you a, here's what our department is like pamphlet. Man, before the internet.
Well, yeah, and the age of information. So let's back up then real quick. Undergrad was a degree in biology?
Yeah, microbiology.
Okay. What were you really, was it still that DNA and that genetics portion of biology that was driving you?
Yeah, yeah. And so I had a microbiology degree. I worked in a lab with doing some microscopy on this weird fungus. And then I got a gig as an intern at a Department of Energy site in Pittsburgh, which was really kind of a good introduction to like research management and stuff like that. But then I decided, you know, I wanted to, finding a job in microbiology in Pittsburgh is hard. So I should go to graduate school because they'll pay me. And I went looking for graduate programs that did interesting microbiology and chose Illinois because it seemed like the most interesting and number of people to work for. And
the winter's most like Pittsburgh.
No, I had no idea. Like, what a huge surprise that was. Wow. It gets cold there. Yeah. Like, really, really bone-destroying cold. We had no idea. So when my wife and I moved to Urbana, we had no idea that there was going to be a day where the wind chill was minus 70 and the outside temperature was minus 20 and they weren't going to cancel class.
Did you have, during that undergrad period, did you have a mentor type or anybody that you kind of glommed onto that helped you, or were you left kind of fidgeting in the dark?
Oh, I think it's kind of a common, you know, oh, you should really do undergraduate research. And then you sort of, you work your way through the little catalog and you like ask this person. And so, the first start was an advisor, still remember her name, Susan Gottfried, who was awesome. And she, you know, gave good guidance and, you know, good advice to how things should work and what I should do. And I ended up in a lab of a guy named Ian Campbell, who, had wear multiple hats and did lots of different and weird things. And he helped get me the Department of Energy internship. And with that, you know, I worked for a guy in project management. And what he said was, you know, he's a chemist by trade. And he was like, I understand, you know, you can get bacteria to do chemical reactions. And I'm like, well, yeah. And so he just presented this problem of, so could you maybe do this? And so after I came up with a bunch of papers and research, I wrote this little report that said, yeah, we can do that. And here's how we do it. And he went, oh, well, that's not hard. Let's do it. And he bullied his way into some guy at the site's lab and said, here's my undergrad. He's going to do this in your lab. And he was such a boss. They went, yes, sir. And that worked. And it led to, you know, a little bit of something, but I was gone by then. So, you know, it wasn't like one person the whole way through. It was sort of like really nice, helpful people passing from one to the next. And I think until graduate school. But you
just admitted that graduate school only came about because, number one, you didn't want to get a real job.
Right.
And graduating college in late 80s, 90s, I speak from experience, there wasn't much going on.
Yeah. Also, not a huge, you know, need for microbiologists.
Right.
Which didn't really think about. But I didn't want to be a biochemistry major because they had to take physical chemistry, PChem. And so, you know, graduate school ended up working out great. I ended up not being a microbiologist anymore.
The only, real quick side note, the only, we'll have a lot of those. The only other microbiologist I know actually went to work for TSR and wrote Dungeons and Dragons, and now he is a game designer. He's been a game designer all those years.
Is this somebody I know?
Bruce Cordell.
Oh, no, okay.
No. The Monte Cook games are what he has attached himself to. He and Monty are old friends, and then he writes the Strange series of RPGs. So, anyway.
Cool.
So you end up at University of Illinois Urbana.
Yep.
How quick does it take you to find your legs there?
Not that bad, really. It was a graduate program that really throws you into the mix quickly in that, you know, you come in, you do 5-week rotations in 3 different labs, you pick one. And so by January of your first year in graduate school, you should be in a research lab and start working on essentially your thesis project. For me, the amazing part was the lab I joined was a guy named Carl Woese, who was literally the third name listed in my microbiology textbook after Van Leeuwenhoek, you know, invented the microscope, and Pasteur worked out how to culture microorganisms, and Woese identified how they were all related on Earth. And so he was essentially like a huge famous microbiologist and super guy, like really great and productive, except that he hadn't had a graduate student in 10 years. And that was because the work he did wasn't really amenable to graduate thesis like stuff. He did a lot of his research was sort of like chugging through things and fishing expeditions that might or might not work. And so I kind of just flamed out there after a year and a half and went to work for some wacky assistant professor. in cell biology, which turned out to be an amazing choice. So
what was the research and what was the dissertation that resulted? Can you still name your?
Yeah. So I don't know. I guess when you boil your thesis down, you should try to be answering big questions, but you know, if you really answer big questions, you answer little things that are attached to big questions. And so the stuff I was doing in the WOS lab was origin of life. How are these really old species of archaebacteria really related? And in that, I was growing things that could only grow without oxygen that grew above the boiling temperature of water and grew really fast. And it was super fun research, but it wasn't leading anywhere. And then I joined a lab of a guy named Chris Doe, who was just actually named to the National Academy of Sciences. And he worked on, at the time we just called it, neuronal specification. You know, how does a single neuron know what it's supposed to do and send a projection and make those connections? Turns out the basic question is the basis of developmental biology, which is how does one cell divide into two and those two become different? Or how does one cell become two and one of them stays the same and one of them is different? And my thesis was on stem cells and the mechanism of how stem cells stay stem cells. And in the time when we did it, we didn't actually use the phrase stem cells. And in retrospect, that was stupid. I worked on genes involved in how to keep a neural stem cell called a neuroblast and have it just make progeny cells that would go off to make neurons. And so I went from growing, if you have any science listeners, I went from growing hyperthermophilic archaebacteria to...
I had some of that on the back of my leg and I scraped it off because it was itchy.
No, you didn't.
No, okay.
You got to go, and... You really have to be in to really come in contact with archaea. You really have to be either sticking your hand up a cow, or bathing in the Great Salt Lake.
Okay.
And then to like Drosophila neural development, which was like a crazy jump, but worked out great. And then Chris was an amazing boss and has been an amazing boss for the rest of my life. So
it is that important to find your leader. I mean, leader probably isn't the right specific term in this. He may start off as a leader in terms of pointing you and giving you direction, but it's more than that. You sent me a couple of articles just to kind of peruse here. And
oh yeah. Stuff from my
certainly graduate. In these two, he's listed and mentioned. Were you guys working side by side, or was it more?
That kind of degree works is, you know, it's a research lab that he's the boss, right? He generates all the funding. We're all working on his idea, right? And his basic research premise is, how do you make two cells different? How do you make a complex nervous system out of 30 precursors? How do you, like, you know, and he would just have a dry erase board and go, do you want to try this project? And you go, yeah. And then one thing leads to another. And, you know, early on in your graduate career, he's not exactly calling the shots, but it's like directing you to do things. And then around in the middle and then to the end, you're like, boss, this is what I did. And he goes, oh, that's amazing. Right. So in this laboratory environment, he's the boss. Like, he's directing all the research. He will be on every paper that comes out of his group. And so that's just guaranteed. I didn't actually send you the one where he actually did an experiment for the paper. But these ones, it's all lab direction and stuff like that.
So he gives you the basis of the idea of the theory, and then it's your job to test that theory out and take it to its conclusion, whether he's right or he's wrong.
Yeah. And then eventually during your graduate career, you're producing your own theories, and he's like, oh, that sounds like a good idea. Go do that. if you're a really good boss, you hire smart people and get out of the way. But until you train them for a few years, they're not really quite ready to go by themselves. And so, you know, at the end of your PhD thesis, you're the independent investigator, and he's just kind of going, cheering you on and making sure you don't get too overburdened or you don't go down the wrong path. It doesn't lead to graduation and those sorts of things.
He gives you enough rope.
Yeah. Yeah.
And lets you dig your hole.
Yep. He lets you dig the hole, but he gives you a rope to pull you out. But it was a great lab to work in. Just like he was a huge, huge advocate of happy people are busy people. And so he would do everything he could to make sure everybody in his research group were happy and therefore would be productive. And them being productive means, you know, he gets the specific aims on his grants done and he gets his funding renewed and he gets tenure and it's all like he's successful if we're all successful. And, you know, if we're all successful, we're all successful. And so the story I tell is, you know, there was a lab down the hall and he was kind of a nice guy, but, you know, they couldn't play a radio in the lab because, you know, it's just too distracting. You know, maybe they could play NPR. Oh, my boss got us a TV. Right. And he got us a TV because he found out that we were going home at 9 p.m. to watch Star Trek reruns. And he went, so if there was a TV, you'd just stay here at 9 p.m. We're like, well, yeah. Boom, there's a TV in the lab. We sat and watched Star Trek reruns. And son of a gun, now we're working until 10:30 or 11 instead of leaving at 9. With Star Trek running in the background. Suddenly it was easier to work on Sunday because you could watch football while you were working.
How much of his management style has driven your management style? Because you're running a lab.
I'm not really, but I try it as much as I can. And I try to use it as advice for students. So I don't have the research group because I'm a teaching faculty. I don't have graduate students and things. But I certainly do the, you know, try to get these smart kids and stay out of their way. And I try to make sure that they're happy and productive. But I also give that as advice to new graduate students or to the undergrads when they're heading off to graduate school, which is you might be trying to join the most famous or fanciest lab, but don't join the one where you have the most fun, because, you know, if you're having fun, you won't be there for 8 hours a day. You'll be there for 12 hours a day. And those extra 4 hours makes you graduate a year or two faster because you're getting that much more work done. And that it's hard for them to like really kind of imagine that, but, you know, being miserable for 8 hours a day because your lab mates are just sort of grouchy and complaining all the time. Yeah, it's no fun. You know, I mean, it's a small group environment. You are really kind of cooped up with the same people every single day. Like, you really need to be happy with who you're hanging around with all day. I look back and I go, that was an amazing experience. And I kind of think, was it unique to us, you know, to our little cohort that was in at the same time? And, you know, when I've talked to other people, the answer is no, his lab's still like that. They're still having a good time. And I see labs that do it. You know, if you find a good research lab, check their lab website. If it doesn't have, you know, pictures from your Halloween party or lab outings, yeah, they're not hanging around together because they don't like each other that much. But yeah, when you find the ones that are out surfing, yeah, like not because not only do they have fun, but they have the ability to go surfing.
Right. You went to grad school. You had mentioned that you're married at the time.
Yeah.
How was that balance?
Well, we were both in graduate school.
Oh, okay.
She was in rhetoric and communication. I was in, I guess, technically cell biology. And so the glory of living, you know, in a college town in the Midwest is that two graduate students can afford to have a child and a nice apartment. So that's the advantage of Illinois over, you know, NYU.
Right.
UCSF.
What was that, the last 2 years, which is what I'm finding that's, you know, that's when you're really figuring out what the dissertation is.
Everything comes together.
Be. Yeah. What was that both emotionally and, you know, how did you weather that storm and getting it done? Did you enjoy the writing?
Oh boy, the writing was actually kind of a funny story. So, one of the papers, the Prospero paper, was a, you know, we had been doing this project. We were trying to figure out how to frame the question. You know, we found this really interesting localization, and it fits in so many ways, but it just didn't have that sort of clincher at the end to bring it all together to send it somewhere fancy. And then, oh goodness, a competitor arrives on the scene, and suddenly that paper needed to go out the door ASAP. And so rather than like torturing ourselves, writing and writing and writing, I think we wrote that paper in a week and submitted it to a journal. And we undercut the, like, Development's a great journal, but the competitor's papers came out in Nature. And so you're like, I think the advice we got from Chris was, your paper will get published. You will still get the postdoc you want. It doesn't really matter. Oh, okay. Phew. That's good. I mean, the person that really mattered for was him. Mm-hmm. And it didn't really matter for him at that point. He already had everything he could imagine in life. And so he wasn't stressed. And so, you know, we got that out the door, and I got that paper done. Oh, okay, let's get this next one out. And so those two papers came out like consecutive months, I think. And I thought I was going to be in graduate school for another year, and turns out funding is a funny thing, and that Chris needed to take another graduate student, and he didn't have a research assistantship lined for them, so he needed to get rid of a graduate student. So I needed to graduate a year early. But I had just published two papers, so my committee was totally cool with that. I thought I was going to be in graduate school for another year after that, and I just stayed on as a postdoc for a year.
So did you not have then the typical dissertation?
Oh, well, it the way these, oh God, the good old days. So the guy I worked for, Chris Doe, he showed me his PhD thesis, and he graduated, got his PhD from Stanford, and he had, as a graduate student, worked out some of like the basic fundamental stuff in developmental biology, right? Just laser ablations and like these really complex, amazing, but simple experiments. And he had these two super well-cited papers, And then he switched into doing Drosophila things and had a paper in Nature and a paper in Science. And the way Stanford was, they didn't really care about what your PhD thesis looked like. They just wanted to see productivity. So his PhD thesis was literally like a 3-page introduction, I think. And then the reprint from his 2 Journal of Neuroscience papers and a reprint from Nature and a preprint of the Science paper all bundled together. So like the page numbering wasn't consecutive. That was like this kind of glossy paper versus like this kind of glossy paper, because it was just things plastered together.
Okay.
And I was like, that's amazing. And he's like, well, that's what you're going to do. Turns out Illinois wouldn't let me do that. So we had to like take all the text out of the paper and make it into all of the two development papers, some other one I was a secondary author on, and then some chapter I wanted to write because I had done all this research, but it gave boring results. It was like, oh, I definitively showed it's not important. Crap. Maybe it'll be important for someone. Eh. And so I think I didn't actually write a thesis. I assembled a thesis. And it took a couple of weeks. Right? There was no, oh, I'm done doing research. I have to sit down and write a dissertation, because your publications are essentially your research result. And different universities are different like irritations about that. Some will like decide, no, you need to sit down and write a multi-hundred page single author document that shows everything that you did. And boy, it wasn't like that in the old days. In the old days, you could literally just staple things together and hand them in. I guess now there's copyright issues.
From folks that I've talked to, that's really kind of the first, I had a PhD who's a metallurgist.
Okay.
A material scientist, PhD in chemistry, and his was really 5 separate research projects. Some of them had connection to one another, but for the most part, he had 5 separate long form papers similar to what mm-hmm. you had produced. Okay. What was the postdoc work?
So I had gotten, I had, those 2 papers and then a bunch of secondary authors and then another really good journal paper out of Chris's lab. And so I got a spectacular postdoc in Norbert Peramon's lab at Harvard Medical School. And if you want to talk like how to feel like a fish out of water, yes, the guy from the Pittsburgh suburbs from the little steel town ends up at Harvard Med. And like, as I think about it, I go, I felt like a fish out of water. No, I think almost all of us did. Like, cause nobody really feels like you're supposed to be there. And it was an amazing, amazing place to work. Super smart, attentive boss. But now I was part of a group with 15 other postdocs and, great support and everything went really well until essentially all of my projects started going south after, in my 3rd year. And at that point I had kind of looked at what the academic track, as I understood it, had for me and went, I don't want to write grants for the rest of my life. And so I took a job in industry.
How did you work out? Cause that's not an easy transformation.
Oh, the industry job?
Yes.
It was actually a super easy one because it was working for, at the time that was still a part of Novartis. Now it's a part of Syngenta. It was their agricultural division and they were using fruit flies as a model system for insecticide discovery. And, I had just done a P PhD and a postdoc in Drosophila research, and they come in and said, we want you to do this particular project. And I'm like, this is a great project. I'm on it. and so that was actually kind of a fun and interesting thing to do until, I think in the third year, after Novartis spun the agriculture business off and formed Syngenta, they rounded us all up into a room and said, as of today, you're all laid off. And it was literally like 45 people in a room. And as of today, you're all laid off.
It's not as bad as what happened to the scientists during Rogue One.
Oh, no, we were not shot. We were actually the opposite of shot. This was a place who had a really kind of a family atmosphere and a very collegial setting, and they were mortified that like they had to let their friends go. And they gave us like 3 months of like where we were supposed to come to work, but mostly focus on packaging up our research to ship to a different site and find a new job. And then also 6 months severance. And then you were still eligible for a year-end bonus and essentially made huge bank by getting fired. It was amazing.
So it wasn't that bad of a,
it was not a bad exit. It was disappointing in that, you know, like we're going to continue this research and we're going to do it in England. You're like, can I live in England? No. But it was a great project. As I think back to that worked out great. Essentially the way it worked out for my career is it worked out as a second postdoc, where I got paid like a good tenured professor, theoretically. It was a fun transition.
From there, where did you go?
So the way it worked then is, you know, now we live in North Carolina, right? Cause that's how I got to the Triangle area. You know, we live here in North Carolina, we have a beautiful house and I have, you know, I had a research group where I had people working with me. And so, you know, we're, kind of part of the local university community and the Drosophila research community. And so I sent out bulk emails to all the professors at Chapel Hill and NC State and Duke to say, look, I've got these great technicians. If anybody's hiring, I highly recommend you get one of these because they're great. And the way it worked out was one guy got a job at Carolina. One guy got a job down the street at another agricultural company. And I got an email from the people at Duke saying, so what are you doing? And turns out they had a staff position running a core facility at Duke open. And I interviewed for that job and got it. And I started there in 2003. And the job running a core facility was this is not a faculty job. This is not a stepping stone to a faculty job. This is just a core facility where you're going to help people do research in fly genetics. And I'm like, okay, that's kind of what I'm good at. And that bizarrely morphed into, hey, can you teach some Drosophila genetics in this class? Well, sure. Well, can you teach a whole class? Sure. Can you teach two classes? Sure. And it did morph into a faculty position. So that was the very non-traditional route to get a job that I didn't actually even know existed when I was in graduate school or a postdoc. Right.
Did you teach when you were doing your graduate work?
I TA'd for the two semesters. So I did the minimalist teaching load you can do to get out of graduate school. Mostly because the boss said, no, what gets you out of graduate school is research. Don't spend much time doing that. So he actually wouldn't let me TA a lab class that I really wanted to. He sent me to the easy teaching load, which did help me get out of graduate school, but you know, it still wouldn't have helped much in the, I didn't know teaching faculty jobs existed because I'd only ever worked at research universities. So
what do you like more, teaching or research?
Oh, no, we can't do that. No, it's going to that. No, I love all of my children equally. There is no favorite there, right? Because it, like, I have to say, hanging around with 20-year-olds is just good for you.
Right. Yes, right? It is. Yes.
It's just, these are high quality people, and I'm just stunned by the amazing things that they do and just excited to see them go off and do awesome things. And like, they keep you on your toes because frankly, they're all smarter than me. So I have to keep up. And then, but then there's that exciting, you know, you do this experiment and you get a result and you go, ah, that's amazing. That's not what I was expecting. Huh. Okay. Let's rethink this, right? Like just that thrill of victory or the thrill of discovery is still so much fun. But yeah, like but what's also nice about it is for me, since I'm 100% teaching that, you know, my research matters a little, but it's not going to make or break me. It's okay to get negative results. It's not the end of the world. Right.
So you don't have the publish or perish hammer over your head?
No, let's just go. It's more of a softer mallet.
Okay.
It's not a 10-pound sledge. It's more of that little thing they use to test your reflexes and knees.
Gotcha.
Where they're like, you know, we'd really like you to publish because, you know, you're doing research with undergraduates and you need to get this stuff out. Okay. But it's not the, I have to publish to get grant money. And if I don't have grant money, then my life is over. And this research has to work so that I can fulfill these. Now it's more of a, if things don't work, that's okay, which is really kind of heartening, you know, like, well, we did this experiment. We think it's going to work this way. We are totally wrong about this. That's okay. I don't have to worry about losing my funding or not getting anything out of it. You know, negative results are okay.
Where do you go from here? I mean, do you see yourself in front of, I don't know, do they use chalkboards anymore? Or is it all just the,
it's dry erase now.
It's all dry erase. Yeah, do you see yourself on the dry erase board, for the next umpteen years?
Well, that's a tough call because I never thought I would be in this position. Right?
What did you? Okay, so let me ask that quick question. What did you see yourself doing either at the beginning of graduate school or after you had your PhD? Did you know?
No, like that was the amazing trick was I don't think I ever had a this is what I really want to do. It was more of a, I enjoy doing these things and I think I want to keep doing these things. Right. So that's why I stayed in Drosophila research from graduate school to postdoc to job because I enjoy it. I'm good at it. I didn't have a great experience TA in graduate school. Never thought I would enjoy teaching until I started doing it. And started doing it for students that actually wanted to be there, which I think is a huge difference. So, you know, that's been kind of fun. Would something come along that was also fun? Well, maybe. I don't know. I can see things. I think I've identified things I don't think I'm good at and that I don't enjoy. And that's like a number one grant writing. Oh, I'm terrible at asking for money. Like you have to have a, you have to have an ego that I don't have to say, I am worthy of your tax dollars. I can only look at that and go, yeah, I'm so not worthy. So I think, you know, I will probably do this until something more fun comes along, and then I'll do the more fun thing.
What classes did you teach this year?
Both fall and spring, I taught a laboratory class in genetics and developmental biology, which is all fruit fly genetics and development. And I taught that to a grand total of 24 students. So like 12 kids each semester. And it's a lab class that meets for 8 hours a week. So I get the kids from like 1:30 to 5:30 on Mondays and Wednesdays. And it's a legit lab, like, you know, it's a research course. They do real actual research where they put together experiments and we do them and we see what the result is. And then we try to put together figures. And so, the research that they do in the class, I'm currently working on a manuscript for one of the projects. And then when this one's out, I have a whole nother paper, or actually probably two, that I need to write. I am not good at writing. I would much rather do almost anything than write. I think it's part of like why I like giving talks is because it's way easier to say things in 40 minutes than to write them down.
Are you finding the time that you've spent? When did you first start going to science fiction conventions, and then or pop culture conventions?
Oh yeah.
And then when did you start engaging in, and rather than attending, being a presenter?
Yeah. So I let's see. I had never dawned on me in a million years to go to one of these things until, I don't know, I think the wife and daughter in cahoots decided that we were going to go to Dragon Con 1 year, maybe 2013.
Okay.
Maybe. And so we went there and they had a super blast. I had moderate amounts of fun. We went again the next year. And we all had a blast. And that year I saw a couple of, like, Dragon Con is a little different in that it has different tracks for programming. Like, there's a Star Wars track and a Star Trek track. And they also have a science track. And I had seen that there was supposed to be a talk about the science of X-Men, and, you know, was like, how could Wolverine really do this? And how could Mystique really do this? And to be perfectly honest, that talk was at 10 a.m. on Saturday or Sunday morning. And after going to bed at 4:30, there was no way I was going to get to that talk, but I really wanted to see what it was about. So I called the professor who gave it. So after Dragon Con, I'm like, I really wanted to see your talk, but I was too hungover. What did you talk about? he went through, like, you know, the rationale, and, you know, and it was that I had just done a Harry Potter genetics thing in my class because my students were bored with talking about fruit fly eye colors. And so we got into a Harry Potter conversation. And, that would probably make a really good talk. And so Stephen Grenade took over running the science track, and he had put out a call for, you know, a solicitation.
Call for presentations.
Yeah, like a solicitation for topics.
Yep.
And I was like, well, I have this. Can I do this? I think that'd be fun and informative. And, I wasn't sure how it was going to work. And I also put together a, you know, biology of Mass Effect for the video game track. and they put Aaron McDonald on the panel with me, and so we did this together. And I wasn't sure how the Harry Potter one was going to go, but I got the worst time slot, which I think is 10 a.m. on Monday morning, which is Labor Day. So right. It's like, okay. Oh, look, everybody's checking out of their hotel and leaving. and they were stunned because it filled the room and they turned like huge numbers of people away for a talk on Monday. And it got really good reviews and everybody really liked it. And so I gave it again in the and that was for a room of like 120. And so I did it again for the young adult literature track, which is where the Harry Potter stuff lives at Dragon Con the next year, except it was a room with like 550 seats and it sold out that one and they turned 100 people away. And so I think I will be doing it again this year for, I think, the fourth year in a row for the young adult lit track because they like it. And a comment I had last year was that even longtime people had wanted to see it, but they've never been able to because the timing has never been right. And so I think this year we're going to see if we can time it at something where it shouldn't have much opposite it, you know? Like, you know, if it's on Saturday afternoon, you're like, do I want to go see Harry Potter Genetics or I want to go see Patrick Stewart? You're going to go see Patrick Stewart. You're like, oh, how about Friday? Like, some people work on Friday. Oh, right. Okay, so I think it might end up being like a late Saturday night or Sunday night kind of thing. But like that, having that talk in hand just was like, oh, well, hey, look, there's a convention in Raleigh. Oh, yeah, I can give it there. And then Aaron talked me into coming out to Denver to Denver Comic Con a couple of years ago. And we did some Mass Effect stuff there and gave the Harry Potter talk twice. and it's just been a, now I look at, do I want to go to this convention? Yeah, sure. I'll submit this. They've been a lot of fun. They're a lot of fun to put together. What I didn't really understand about the whole thing was how much I would learn putting the talk together. So now I end with a why this isn't stupid, which is, you know, what I learned making this talk. Because, you know, academics look at this and go, like literally had a guy look at it and go, how much time did you spend on that? Or any like, well, that was kind of a jerk thing to say. But, you know, now it ends with, and here's all the things I learned putting together this silly waste of time. We've been fun. I think I've got Awesome Con coming in June and Dragon Con in September this year. So we'll cut down on the number of conventions.
So did your wife stay down the academic track?
She did not. She actually went into recruiting and HR and then eventually decided that wasn't for her, went to law school, and she is now a lawyer.
Okay.
So she's usually my example for how what you do for a living shades what you do because, you know, we all look at lawyer shows on TV and here they are presenting new evidence during trial or new surprise witnesses. Like, you can't do that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You, and that's where I look at it and go, oh, yeah, that doesn't work that way. And that's where, you know, in video games, I get excited when things do work that way. Yeah.
And your daughter who conned you into going to your first Dragon Con, did she catch the academic bug?
She is currently an undergraduate in art school. And I think the con thing really infected her because she makes fursuits, like, you know, yeah, full body fursuits for customers on commission, right? Okay. So they had sent her a picture of some poorly sketched out thing and she resketches it and sends them a suit.
Eric Spanner, are we going to see you here in Denver at a Comic-Con someday soon?
See, I'd like to, but boy, it's spending a lot of money to do these things. I think that
you don't get paid for that, do you?
No, that is the real disappointment of you know, it doesn't seem right that so much programming is free. Man, I spent 4 digits to go provide programming for Denver Comic Con. So I think we're trying to cut down the number of ones this year. So Awesome Con is only happening because I'm giving a talk at the Smithsonian the day before on how to make Captain America. Modern biotechnology, man, we can make Captain America. Sort of. And then Dragon Con is just our yearly vacation. So
it's easy to get to Hotlanta from North Carolina.
You would think, and that's true, because we get on an airplane and fly to an hour and a half.
Goes back to that whole thing. Out west, I think nothing of jumping in a car for 6 hours. It's not a problem.
It's funny because the drive to Atlanta is fine. It's the actual Atlanta part, right? And it's then here you are with a car. You know, like, okay, how does it belong? Does it take, how much does it cost to keep a car there for that long? You're like, that's the price of an airplane ticket. Okay, fine. We're just going to fly. If you could just leave the car at a friend's house outside of Atlanta, that might be worthwhile. But the fact that you have to drive through some of the dumbest traffic I've ever witnessed on your way to spending $40 some a day to park your car makes the flight all the more worthwhile. So.
And what's your cosplay going to be this year?
No, see, I like there's certain things I can do and certain things I can't do, and I just don't have the time or skills or energy to make decent cosplays. What I have done though is. I am okay with ordering patches off of Etsy and putting them on good looking hockey jerseys. So I might have to go. I think I might make a new Mass Effect Andromeda hockey jersey. Because it's a different color scheme and a nice logo. Nothing good. Although I like the number of people that told me I need to get a Hamilton costume.
No.
It's actually a pretty high one.
We've been contemplating THX 1138 this year.
Really?
I've never seen THX done. My kid's about an inch and a half taller than I am now, so he would be a perfect enforcer. It's my bald guy.
We'll see if anybody gets that. That's a pretty...
The challenge with that one is I don't know how to do the silverish mask for him. But I'll get it figured out.
Yeah.
I'll just result to mashing my two favorite things, Star Wars and Hitchhiker's Guide, where I am the Jedi Knight with a towel over his shoulder and the lightsaber on his belt. In my Jedi robe, bathrobe.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when is Denver Comic Con this year?
Denver Comic Con is late June. I got to look at it again because we were trying to balance Father's Day camping and some other stuff.
I had to rule that one out because of the DC trip, I think. Because the one we did Denver Comic Con before, it was Memorial Day weekend.
Memorial Day. Yeah, it's kind of bounced around. Several years ago, it was Father's Day weekend, and that kind of mushed us up, and it's been Memorial Day. So we'll get it figured out. Eric Spann, if you ever find yourself in Denver, Colorado, you are always welcome around my campfire.
Thank you very much.
And we'll stay in touch, and thanks for piling it high and deep today.
Yes, anytime. If you need anything else, just holler.
Eric Spanna, thank you very much for your time on that early morning back in May on International Towel Day. It was a great conversation and quite the journey for Eric Spanna. And I want to say thanks to Aaron McDonald for putting the two of us together. Aaron was a guest a couple of episodes ago, and she and Eric do a nifty little bit at the science fiction conventions about science and science fiction. So thanks. Piled High and Deep, the podcast. You can find us on the internet at Twitter, at PhD Podcast. Also, my bloviations on the web at themountaingeek.net. The music behind me comes from the Swedish band Dungen. Last year, they did an album where they reimagined the music to the 1926 classic animated movie, The Adventures of Prince Ahmed. The album is called Hoxen. I won't even try and pronounce any of the song titles for you, but if you like nifty stuff in your ears, check out the band Dungen. Well, that'll do it for episode 9 of Piled High and Deep, the podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Keep shoveling.